perception brings out the most faithful, most academic, most intelligent, of course. We hope we'll be joined by more as we continue. This morning's session is Preparedness for and Principles of Zion Building, and our presenter will be Dr. Alan Lambert. He is a sociologist, a Zionist, and an entrepreneur. I'm sure we'll find out how the Zionist entrepreneur business is as we listen to him. His background is in regional planning, and I believe that the few of you who are here are in for an interesting discussion this morning. His paper will be commented on by Ron Mullen, whose presentations you may have already heard at Sunstone. He is an architect, now writing some fiction, and also writing a book on ecologically sound community development. We will now turn the time over, gentlemen, and when you have questions, will you please repeat the question into the microphone so that they'll be on the tape.
And we're supposed to end at what time?
We end. This session ends at 9:45.
Okay. A couple of quick questions.
I prefer to sit so I can select from my notes as we go along more easily, so I got them spread out here. Let me ask a couple of quick questions. Is there anyone here who's not Mormon? Okay. Some of the language is very Mormon-oriented, and I need to know whether it needs explication. My own particular background as a Mormon has led me to, and commitment to it, led me to be committed to the notion of Zion building, and as a professional sociologist, became interested in the underlying principles, social structures, and political economy of different forms of society and how we could develop that for Zion. I'm not alone in this. What I represent here, I no longer know how much is mine and how much is some friends of mine, Gordon Wagner and Gordon Thomason and even Hugh Nibley and others. So if some of it you may think you've heard or read elsewhere, don't be surprised. But I try to bring it together in some different ways and have been doing it over the years. And there's both a preaching element to it and an analytical element to it. Probably try to focus more on the theoretical and analytical part today. Select out those who may want more full statements are welcome to write me or leave me a note, and I can send you a diskette with a collection of stuff on it by me and others. And I would, those of you who have not read Hugh Nibley's Approaching Zion, I strongly recommend it as a good source of preaching and motivation. Okay. Catalog or whatever it's called, the schedule, I had sent in a statement that I was a Zionist, a sociologist, and an entrepreneur. The entrepreneur side is that I've been in business for several years and had a variety of businesses and know what it means to start them, know what it means to be involved in the capitalist society. Not a purely academic in these affairs. They also slightly changed my summary, so it's a little different, but that's not terribly critical. Let me start with one of the points I make there is in the summary that's printed is that a commitment to understanding of and beginning attempts to implement Zion are essential, not just for eternal salvation, if you will, but also for the salvation of the church and the people here and now. And as a sociologist, I would predict a major collapse, not just on a global scale, but internally in the United States within a decade. Major catastrophes related to prices of gasoline and the effect on transportation systems, as well as the continuing decay of infrastructure, but all sorts of other things. But with that as a context, we can think about how we might go about redesigning and implementing a new socioeconomic order with the collapse of an old previous system. So here's some basic premises, and then I'll get on to the socioeconomic aspects, theological and theoretical, of a Zion society. There's obviously a lot more to say than I can possibly say here. Basic premises: the restoration of the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ and of the holy priest in these latter days is for the purpose of preparing a Zion society as a habitat for the holy and as an ensign to all the world. Zion is a place, a people, and a pattern. It is the place to which the Messiah shall come and from which he shall reign in righteousness, as well as a refuge for the repentant. It is the people, the nation of God, i.e. those who acknowledge his lordship, experience the mighty change of heart, and adopt his way of life. It is the pattern of the celestial order built up in the beginning by the city of Enoch and established in these times as a model for all those who seek a more excellent way. Zion, both as a pure in heart and as a social system, can be developed only in the Lord's way. His way includes a social system and economic organization derived from principles of consecration and stewardship. Zionism and consecration and stewardship are fundamental and essential elements of the whole armor of God. CNS derives from, depends upon, and manifests grace and love. The implementation of CNS thus represents the imitation of Christ in economic matters. God's grace gives us what we do not deserve and cannot earn. Part of his grace concerns atonement. Another part involves the abundance of the earth. Love of the Lord and Christ-like love lead us to love all of his creation, and especially our fellow humans. So we acknowledge his sole ownership, try to act as good and faithful servants whose stewardship is to multiply and replenish, i.e. to enhance and beautify, the earth, and to share our blessings equally with all, especially the less fortunate, and without regard for worthiness, etc. Remember, we are all sinners and fall short of the glory of God. In this manner, we become as saviors on Mount Zion, assisting God in his work and glory of bringing to pass the immortality and eternal life of man, and in the process work out our own salvation by extending grace into the economic sphere of life. Anyone who has received his or her endowments has already covenanted to consecrate and to establish the cause of Zion. The covenant is in the present tense, not future, and it is wholehearted and unconditional. We live under that law and are accountable for that principle now. We must and can find ways to begin to implement it in our personal lives and among small groups of friends and saints, and to seek its establishment throughout the church. And it is a part of the gospel to preach to the world. The importance of Zion and CNS to the church is evident in the many attempts to implement them. This alternative economic system, which stood in direct contrast to American capitalism, was as much a focus of antagonism among Mormons as polygamy. I've got a large collection of quotes. One of those who are interested in some academic sleuthing in the BYU archives can find something called the Logan Temple Lectures, delivered in the 1885-1886 years. John Taylor, President Taylor, reinstituted the School of the Prophets and had a series of lectures delivered. Charles Nibley, who was then in the presiding bishopric and later in the First Presidency, delivered a series of lectures on political economy, which very few people know about, and you'd find very interesting in reflecting the attitudes of many church leaders about modern capitalism, or what they perceived as modern capitalism. Brigham Young has many quotes. Let me read just one to introduce what I would call Mormon economics. This is actually from an apostolic circular of 1875 signed by the First Presidency and the 12. The experience of mankind has shown that the people of communities and nations among whom wealth is the most equally distributed enjoy the largest degree of liberty, are the least exposed to tyranny and oppression, and suffer the least from luxurious habits which beget vice. One of the great evils, the growth of wealth in the hands of a comparative few individuals, and the monstrous power which this accumulation of wealth gives to a few individuals and a few powerful corporations they found to be happening in the church. One more quote from Brigham Young alone. We will take a moral view, a political view, and we see the inequality that exists in the human family. We see servants that labor early and late and that have not the opportunity of measuring their hours. They cannot go to school nor hardly get clothing to go to meeting in on the Sabbath. I have seen many cases of this kind when a young lady would have to take her clothing on a Saturday night and wash it in order that she might go to meeting on Sunday with a clean dress. Who is she laboring for? For those who, many of them, are living in luxury, and to serve the classes that are living on them, the poor, laboring men and women, are toiling, working their lives out to earn that which will keep a little life in them. Is this equality? No. What is going to be done? The Latter-day Saints will never accomplish their mission until this inequality shall cease on the earth. Now, I have a copy of a letter that Brigham Young wrote from an interesting place in England, Manchester, the birth of industrial capitalism, in 1840, same time that Engels and Marx were observing Manchester, which led to their 1844 publication on the condition of the working class in England. And it's a long letter, but the portion that deals with the condition of the working class there in Manchester, you could exchange it with Marx and you wouldn't know the difference. You wouldn't know who the author was if I were to read it to you without telling you who wrote it. The phrase Mormon economics leaves much to be desired, but we use it for the sake of communication efficiency. If Mormonism is too ambiguous, so economics is too narrow a term. An economy consists of social, cultural, political, and biophysical phenomena, as well as production and distribution processes. The LDS Church's explicit theology and goal is a total way of life in which economic processes and institutions are subordinated to spiritual and community concerns and personal progress. Even as a means to achieving these ends, economics should be secondary. Inasmuch as the transformation and distribution of material resources and assignment of significance to events and behavior represent the two most fundamental of human activities, the linking of economics and religion seems most natural or appropriate. Great social analysts such as Karl Marx, Max Weber, and more recently Christopher Dawson and Wilhelm Repke have recognized a relationship between them, whatever their disagreements about the causal direction. Only in the modern capitalist world system have we seemed to forget the intimate relationship between the two. And since religion is inseparable from ethical issues, necessarily implying a moral definition of and judgment about all human activities and relations, the importance of an explicit connection between economics and religion cannot be overemphasized. Despite its obvious relevance to development studies and efforts, and despite such monographs as we can cite, relatively little is known about the socioeconomic system of the Mormons, particularly as practiced during a half century of building nearly 300 communities and resettling some 70,000 people from diverse ethnic, social class, and national backgrounds. Yet there are lessons to be learned from the development experience and theory of this group. Any attempt, like the present one, to abstract essential elements from a complex system and to distill them into a few pages is fraught with difficulty. Communication is complicated by the religious embeddedness of economic concepts and the radically different meanings sometimes found in Mormon language. One has only to read the Book of Mormon and compare it to an 1828 Webster's Dictionary to see that some of the meanings we attach to or interpret in the Book of Mormon today are quite different from what Joseph Smith would have seen it as. and, of course, many aspects will be omitted. Development of the Mormon Commonwealth in the face of extreme hardship and societal opposition was due in large part to its persistence in cooperative and communal enterprise based on a social theory promoting unity and equality, frugality and independence. Integrity of spiritual and material aspects of life, hierarchical organization and central planning, combined with voluntary cooperation, community socialization of property and surplus, combined with partial freedom of enterprise and individual initiative, production according to capacity and consumption according to need, positive use of public agencies, sacrifice and pious devotion to an ideal of the kingdom of God. Much of the ignorance of Mormon experience is due to its religious character, and part due to its peculiarity or uniqueness. skip here some. For those who see that the present emerged from the past, that the shape of contemporary society has historical roots, the 19th century was especially important. It witnessed the emerging dominance of industrial capitalism and associated secular economic theories such as its bourgeois apologia and Marxian antithesis. Numerous variations on these two themes found religious homes, such as the current liberation theology. Without denying cultural context, Mormonism claims its theory and practice stand outside of and in contrast to both capitalist and Marxist trends. Indeed, Mormonism, in its socioeconomic aspects, promotes a system alternative to both, in short, a third way. And while various individual items of LDS belief and behavior may, when taken in isolation, resemble particular items found in either capitalism or Marxism, Mormonism as a system differs dramatically from them and other models having roots in Greek thought and its modern Western derivatives. Although 20th century popular Mormon culture often seems to emphasize what many interpret as consistent with capitalism, it can be argued that such is merely a temporary and superficial shell which will be easily shucked when the call comes to revitalize the efforts and critique begun in the previous century. Such an attitude is quite alive in many of the top leadership of the LDS Church, as well as among many ordinary members. The ease with which seemingly entrenched customs can be changed by prophetic utterance and accepted and implemented by church members was evident in the 1978 modification of priesthood practice regarding blacks. The Mormon socioeconomic theory is more properly called consecration and stewardship, or CNS for short. Implementation was often called the United Order. As divinely instituted, it's based on a contractual scheme of justice. The content of this system represents a consistent theoretical whole in which justice and compassion are primary and are embedded in an institutionalized system of social welfare criteria, which may be contrasted with the individualistic welfare premise of neoclassical economics from which the notion of consumer sovereignty derives. As any society consists of certain cultural components and social structures, reflecting and expressing beliefs, values, organizational arrangements, decision procedures and political mechanisms, production processes and resource allocations, property concepts and relations, etc., so CNS must propose a theory and institutional arrangements for such. There are many questions we can address. Let me provide a summary of principles. Consecration and stewardship objectives may be summarized as sufficiency for all. Everyone gets what is really needed from the community storehouse. Superfluity for none. No one receives more than what is needed for or more than exceeds just wants. Equality of treatment, of family standard of living, i.e. consumption stewardship, and of access to employment, i.e. production stewardship. Equality of consumption means there is a community standard of living which serves as a basic guideline for determining the quantity of sustenance goods and money to be allocated to each family by the community representative judge, with variations according to family size and special circumstances, etc. Equality in the sphere of production means equal access to the means of production through claim on the central treasury for a stewardship to manage. All are entitled to use the means of production under the same conditions. Stewardship may vary from having a broom to sweep, to a lathe, to machine tools, to a bank to manage the finances. The size of the stewardship is irrelevant. The inequality in production stewardships will exist in that one person may have different skills, capacities, and desires than another, but neither the size of the stewardship nor the role therein will have any bearing on income or standard of living. Every principle has a purpose and a promise. CNS is the principle whose purpose is to prepare a people to receive the Messiah and to return to God and live a celestial order, which entail the development of divine attributes and the building of a Zion society. And its promise is maintenance in mortality and exaltation in eternity, i.e. temporal and spiritual salvation. If CNS is the principle, the United Order was the practice in the 19th century church. I'll skip over the examples there. to elaborate more on consecration and stewardship, which are the central concepts in the LDS theology as regards God's ideal for a just socioeconomic system, and as such may be considered the basis of a celestial mode of production, which serves as a cornerstone of a divine or Zion society. As a system, CNS has numerous characteristics which distinguish it as a mode of production, some of which are alluded to here. The CNS is not utopian in the usual sense of that term, is apparent from the many attempts Mormons made over nearly 60 years to implement some real form of the theory in every place they settled, as well as by the fact that it remains today an active part of belief and anticipation and finds partial implementation in current church welfare program. If society may be defined primarily as a socioeconomic system for human utilization of the fruits of the earth, then any particular set of activities and their associated relationships for organizing the transformation of natural resources for human sustenance and the distribution of subsistence and surplus may be designated a mode of production. Societies may be characterized by their dominant mode of production, feudalism, capitalism, communism, and, in our case, Zionism. Consecration and stewardship are the primary theological principles and may be considered a heavenly or celestial mode of production. Consecration acknowledges that the earth and everything in and on it were created or organized by and belong to God, that the earth in its entirety is His, and that humans have no right or title to any of it, except as He established or permitted. We consecrate back to Him what is rightfully His in order to heal that which has been desecrated through sin and ignorance. Through sacred ceremony and covenant, we formally recognize His ownership by deeding and dedicating all that we have, time, talents, gifts, property, wealth, etc., back to Him for use as He sees fit in the building up of His kingdom and society, in the redemption of His children, and in the perfecting of His people. This contract perpetuates, extends, and individualizes the covenant God made long ago with Israel and others all the way back to Adam and Eve, and reaffirms the relationship and mutual promises established in our premortal existence with our heavenly parents. In that sense, we see a Rawlsian, the primordial premise for the Rawlsian system of justice. Stewardship is the sacred assignment received back from the Lord for a portion of His property and of His work and glory. It is the calling to act as His agent to care for and to multiply, replenish, restore, and beautify some small segment of divine creation. It represents responsibility without ownership, i.e., usufruct rights and management privileges. As agents, we will be held accountable by Him for our use or abuse of resources, relationships, and personal talents. Individuals receive specific stewardships by oath and covenant through the Lord's community representatives, such as the prophet or bishops or community committee. Since property is consecrated by covenant to God and deeded to the ecclesiastical community, stewards can neither buy nor sell nor destroy property assigned to them. Nor do they have, in contrast to capitalist legal theory, nor do they have the right to retain or accumulate surpluses generated therefrom. The stewardship rule is that the earth's resources are to be used with judgment, quoting the DNC, not to excess, neither by extortion. Stewardships for production are independent of those for consumption. Thus, Mormon ideas about socioeconomic justice begin with the doctrine that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, that the inhabitants of the earth are granted limited use rights to her resources, that as stewards we will be judged in the resurrection, and that we are all voluntarily accepted this plan in a premortal council. It is also believed that the earth is full and there is enough to spare for all her inhabitants, but only when we abide by our covenant or contract in following His gospel plan and by doing it in His way, that is, building up His kingdom through CNS. The theology holds that life is eternal with this mortal stage on earth, but one in a series which precedes and succeeds it, this mortal stage. The purpose of life is progression, i.e., to become ever more like God, our heavenly parents. For children to become more like their parents, for us to become more godlike, requires learning to live in the same way as He does, He, they. CNS is part of the divine lifestyle and as such is presented as a model for our development. Since God is perceived as real and personal, it is perceived that CNS can actually, is believed that CNS can actually be implemented with divine assistance. Indeed, it is believed that God cannot magnify his glory, extend immortality and eternal life to more and more of his offspring, and multiply exalted worlds without our assistance in building a Zion society. That is, God's glory is contingent on our exaltation, which in turn is dependent on our freely choosing a path of divine development, which includes the implementation of an institutional system supportive of his way of life. God desires the best for his children and has prepared the earth for our use and learning. He gave in abundance in order to provide for all. But what we do with that inheritance is up to us. He asks us to be anxiously engaged in a good cause of our own choosing and initiative and to forsake wrongdoing. But we are free to choose otherwise because we are independent moral agents whose free agency is an eternal law of the universe. As with any law, there are associated promises and punishments or positive and negative consequences. Thus, those who reject CNS and other elements of God's lifestyle lose the right to return to his society and to become eternal co-inheritors of all that he has. With such a belief, Mormons have considerable incentive to pursue the path of CNS. Implicit in the foregoing and explicit elsewhere is the notion that an essential characteristic of God and Godhood is justice. God will act justly, and it is expected that humans will be accountable for their degree of conformity to this principle. The manner in which we treat our brothers and sisters, who comprise all of humanity, will come back on us. As we judge, so shall we be judged. Balancing the demands of the law is mercy, exhibited by God in the grace extended us through the Savior's atonement. This grace teaches us that we are all imperfect, so that tolerance of others' failings becomes another divine attribute to be imitated in the economic sphere. Justice and mercy combined undergird the principle of equality in spiritual and material matters. All are equal before God because all are equally divine offspring, and therefore literally siblings in a single family. Therefore, all are equal as potential co-inheritors of all that the Father hath. All are also equally mortal and sinners, inheritors of ignorance and death, and equally subject to grace. Since equality is a spiritual law, it has a material concomitant. God commands that we share equally in the resources he has provided. In essence, to the degree we support socioeconomic inequality, we deny God's justice, mercy, and way of life. In CNS, participation is an important principle. Each individual has both opportunity and obligation to participate in economic and political processes, to seek and perform productive work, to consume justly, and to contribute to allocation and development decisions. The idler, neither rich nor poor, I might add that in the DNC when it says the idler shall not benefit from the sweat of the worker, Joseph Smith meant explicitly the idle rich. Those who gain their revenue from owning capital rather than from personal productive involvement. The idler will not eat the bread of the laborer, but neither will the incapacitated or less able be denied. No person capable of work will be left without some productive role in stewardship. Each person will work to the degree that his or her capacity will allow. But, in accord with the principle of equality, there will be no necessary connection between quantities of production and of consumption. One may consume either more or less than the value of one's production. An underproducer will consume more when his or her wants are just. Performance approaches personal capacity, and production will yield less than community standard of living. On the other hand, an overproducer will not be granted the right to consume more than community standard permits. Though some have wondered how this would affect the incentive of people to produce more than community consumption standard. The great theory of capitalism is you've got to give people profit in order for them to work. Well, that's simply nonsense. In the history of the world, the vast majority of societies have not been capitalist. They've been cooperative, the small societies of the world. People manage to work and feed themselves quite adequately. In fact, anthropologists have discovered that the majority of small societies in the history of the world probably average 20 to 25 hours labor a week to, the notion of the savage that worked 80 hours a week to starve to death simply isn't true. Those who work harder because of joy and pride in productive or creative activity and for reasons of Christ-like service will still work near a reasonable personal maximum. Those who work harder wholly and solely for personal consumption might reduce their productive efforts. But since selfishness will not inherit his kingdom, this will not be a problem in celestial society. And in a society of CNS organizations, those motivated primarily by greed will either leave the community or change. Common consent is the name given to the process and right of members to counsel in and consent to community policy and enterprise decisions. In general, the process is one of collaboration in design, consensus in decision, and sustaining the implementation. It is a democratic process broader than elections and majority rule. CNS as a system has numerous characteristics which distinguish it as a mode of production. For example, the role of money, of the market, of prices, of property, of planning differs greatly from their role in capitalism or socialism, at least as they exist in this world. In capitalism, for example, money serves several functions in addition to being a medium of exchange. For example, it also acts as a mechanism for expropriating so-called surplus value from labor and as a store of value so that it can claim interest on its use. Since it is owned by relatively few members of modern society, those two characteristics serve private accumulation and therefore to exacerbate individual and family inequality and uneven regional development or transfer of wealth. In contrast, money in CNS will be no more than a medium of exchange, will be owned and controlled by the community as a whole rather than a few, and the very concept of interest will be absent. Thus, money will no longer serve as a mechanism of exploitation, stratification, and wealth transfer. Likewise, markets and prices will have a much more restricted role in CNS. The market might be one of several factors determining production levels, but it will not determine the price or profit in any overriding manner. In consequence of property and planning concepts, markets and prices in CNS will not correspond to those in capitalism. The market will not constitute the dominant organizing principle of society, nor will an invisible hand determine production quantities and prices for most items. Markets may be more places of exchange than determinants of the conditions of exchange. Certainly, not of the distribution of income and wealth. Thus, CNS rejects the notion of market clearing prices in favor of a just price based on technically and consensually determined real social costs of production consistent with the requirements of equity across space and time. Intergenerational equity is an important one here. For example, what would be the price of oil today if the fifth generation from now could bid in the market for it? There's no such thing as true market pricing in such things. Because all possible participants can't bid in the market. Clearly, both consumption and production will be subject to collective regulation and planning for coordination of production, allocation of resources, and limitation on consumption. In accord with the objective needs and expressed desires of the consenting community and within the constraints of intergenerational justice. However, in contrast to the planless or random regulation by American government and profit planning of private corporations, or to bureaucratic banalities of the Soviet system, this planning will involve development directed towards certain consensually established outcomes and away from others. It will include many qualitative objectives rooted in eternal values and spiritual truths, as well as intergenerational equity, sustainability, just wants, equality, etc. To be noted is that market forces are not necessarily precluded, but are restricted and subordinated. Property in CNS obviously has a different meaning than in capitalism. While participants may have property rights in personal consumables, such as clothes, furnishings, etc., they will not have private ownership of land or other natural resources, nor of money as a medium of exchange and representation of value. The community will be the repository of capital, enterprises, and surplus, as well as natural resources, thereby retaining the rights of transfer and of definition of appropriate uses and limitations on production. The community mechanism for such will be a central treasury or bishop's storehouse. Surpluses will not be retained by stewards or enterprises, but will revert to the central treasury. This community fund will be the source of capital for new or expanded stewardships. For community development, such as infrastructure, schools, libraries, museums, parks, concerts, hospitals, whatever. For increasing standard of living of the entire community. For those incapable of self-sufficiency. And for assistance to other communities which are less fortunate. Outreach. Obviously, private accumulation of wealth cannot occur in such a system. Any accumulation will be at the community level. A common treasury held on behalf of the Lord and for all his children. And because the materialism of private accumulation does not rule, the modern mania for growth and conspicuous consumption will disappear, as will much of the environmental degradation which result therefrom. CNS has additional system characteristics of interest. It is conservationist. It has conservationist and restorative tendencies because consumption levels are defined by basic needs, just wants, and spiritual criteria. And because the production imperative is replenishment and sustainability in order to meet the criterion of justice for future generations whose quality of life is valued as highly as that of the current living generation. Also, production is seen as a medium of self-expression, for beauty and self-actualization, as well as of subsistence. Because the materialism of private accumulation does not rule, it is oriented to the service of others rather than to self-interest. One benefits only indirectly, as one contributes directly to the well-being of the community as a whole, or of some other individual. Production is for the equal well-being of all rather than to maximizing personal gain and consumption. Cooperation rather than competition characterize production relations. Sharing replaces accumulation. Harmony and unity are set against polarization and conflict. I saw a recent argument by somebody that competition is an eternal rule of God that governs the celestial kingdom. And he had 7 or 11 or some number, I've forgotten, proofs that competition is the rule of the celestial kingdom. I was astonished as a sociologist. Simply not the rule of most societies in history. It's not even a rule in biology. The common talk is that competition is the governing rule of ecosystems, but it's not. There's competition only in the abstract sense that there are limited resources and this species or that species may be limited in size, but they don't directly compete. There are very few species in an ecosystem that directly compete for the same resource. It's a cooperative system, by and large, a natural ecosystem. CNS, as political economy, tends to be local and regional, with human-scale enterprise in accord with the model of priesthood and congregational organization of the church. Notice I said priesthood and congregational organization, not necessarily the centralized tower of power. Relatively autonomous local units are kept small, but are coordinated at regional and global levels. We conclude that CNS as a system exhibits a very high degree of social efficiency and justice because of the following features. I have 17. I'm going to have to stop here. Decision making, property system accumulation, external financing, employment guarantees, productive work, occupational free choice incentives, equality, global distribution, intergenerational justice, environmental husbandry, internalization of externalities. There's a big one in modern economics. Modern economics comes up with its silly little models, two-person models, which are moronic to begin with. Anybody who looks at human relationships knows that as soon as you go from two people to three people, you get coalition formation. So two-person models of any social system are stupid. But beyond that, anything they can't account for, they call an externality. So naturally, their accounts balance. All the big things are outside their accounting system. Economic expansion being limited by the requirements, only a family, global, and temporal justice, just savings, investment principle, civil and religious freedom, etc. Gives you a flavor for my interpretation, if you will, of the theology and how I would go about elaborating the principles of CNS. We'll pursue that in questions and comments any degree and ways we can begin it today or possibilities, therefore, whatever. Let me give you the mic. You want to stand? Or
I'll sit also. I think Alan has written a very thoughtful paper. I agree with most of what he has to say in the paper. We need to be reminded that the idea of Zion, the kingdom of God and a promised land, was a very strong teaching in the early church, and if the church is to be consistent, must honor its original teachings. And it didn't preach an ordinary Zion. The concept of conservation, or consecration and stewardship, was not limited to warden stakes, as he said, but it was a very ambitious building of the city of God. It was a new socioeconomic idea at the time, and the cooperative economic system was as much a threat to outsiders as was polygamy, and I think we forget that. And, of course, all these things were stressed in his paper. Okay, where I would disagree is that these ideas are all alive and well. I don't think church leaders have the foggiest notion of what the law of consecration and stewardship is all about, of how to implement a cooperative society or build a city of God. The main purpose of the 20th century church has been missionary work. I don't think that is going to change. Common consent. He speaks of a very broad idea of democracy, and there's a real conflict in a theocracy, and I think today democratic processes don't exist in the church beyond the planning of a ward dinner.
Which are few in number.
The modern mania for growth and conspicuous consumption will disappear is another point that I would tend to disagree with. I don't think this will happen until after the second coming. In Washington, D.C., they referred to the aggressive Mormon businessmen as being driven by the Protestant ethic with a Mormon afterburner. I think it's a very poignant point on and in which I'm in full agreement that all human beings are equal and their claim on and they have an equal claim on nature's abundance, and we should work toward a sustainable society and a sustainable economy. I just returned from Scandinavia, and I'd like to report that socialism is alive and well. And the irony is these countries with 5% church attendance are attempting to build a secular Zion through cooperation and sharing. And I must say it's very impressive. There are no huge, grotesque mansions being built. Most of the housing is about the same size. There are no slums. There are beautiful parkways with separate paths for pedestrians and bicycles. Early in the paper, Alan spoke of a natural linkage between economics and religion. But in America, and the Mormon culture particularly, capitalism rules. Many Mormons are capitalists first and Christians second. An example is the elders' quorum leadership that recommends the members to purchase guns to protect their year's supply of food. Somehow the message was missed. For the moment, I'd put my money on the socialist experiments in Scandinavia, who unknowingly have created a more Christian society than conservative Christians of the United States because they already are willing to share, to cooperate. They are very un-Republican. If I were to attempt a socialist experiment, the Utah of today might be the last place I would choose. And I speak from experience. I attempted to organize a cooperative farm with 30 members, where 30 members were to share 300 acres together, and there were no takers. I think the understanding and work of democratic processes and a willingness to share and work for the good of everyone are not highly developed skills and attitudes among the Mormons. Until some respect is shown for socialism, we will continue to be limited by capitalism, committed to growth, and the inevitable poisoning of the planet.
I think I have to agree with most of your empirical assessments. Let's have questions. Yes. The question is, do I foresee, did I predict that the triggering factor in starting the church on a CNS path would be the collapse of society in the next 10 years or so? I would answer yes, basically. You want me to elaborate? No. It had nothing to do with partisan politics, but the collapse of society, transportation systems. If we look at the debt that we all talk about, the national debt, and look at it in ecological terms, we have an overshoot condition. And in the 1980s, we had a modest growth rate based upon the most extraordinary Keynesian deficit spending in the history of the world. And that was during a time of peace and prosperity, quote unquote. And so what we have in financial terms in this country is an overshoot condition. What happens when you get an overshoot in ecosystem is eventual collapse. You've borrowed against the future beyond its ability to restore itself. And that's going to show up in many, many ways, including our inability to restore simple infrastructure. We look at what happened in Chicago when underground pipes were collapsed. The estimate in regional planners to restore just Chicago and New York City and some of the major cities, the infrastructure, the tunnels that are 100 years old that contain sewers and electrical and all this other stuff is over $100 billion. What's going to happen to those cities when those tunnels start collapsing on a daily basis? New York City is losing through its sewer system nearly 50% of all the water it sucks into the city from all the rural regions because of the leaks. What's going to happen to Southern California? Right now, the Colorado River Basin that feeds water, Southern California is using 40% more than its legal right. Utah and Arizona, that's why the Central Utah and Central Arizona projects were delayed so long by the politicians, is because when those come online fully, the legal allocation made in 1960 to Southern California, there's going to be war. What's Southern California going to do when you take away 100 million acre-feet of water from them? Where are they going to get it? What's going to happen when that when 15 million people lose 40% of their water? We're in disastrous condition like that.
Wow.
Potentially, and we've managed to mask it. And there's literally dozens of these things throughout the country, infrastructure, finances, collapse in agricultural systems, and the price of oil is going to go through the sky. And when that does, we can no longer transport lettuce from Mexico to New York, etc. You know, tomatoes and everything else. You're skeptical about the ability of humans to live consecration and stewardship. Is that a sufficient summary?
Well, I'm wondering particularly the democratic ideal of it, given our culture is so undemocratic.
in particular the ability to live a democratic or to implement. I don't like the term democratic because of its current cultural context. Let me respond this way. First point is that social systems get transformed in two basic ways. They either collapse and you go through the dark ages before they rebuild, oversimplify history a bit, the common oversimplification, I might add, or you have revolutions. And very often the two go together. You get collapses and revolutions going together. Will we have a what will force people to do something that they're not prepared to do? I guess that's the question I ask, because empirically I would say, yeah, people are not ready by and large. I think there are many who are ready. I think there are many who would start today if they had the opportunity. But the legal and political and economic conditions of the United States are far stronger against implementation of something like this than they were 100 years ago. It's be very difficult. But there are people doing various things. There are ways to do things. But on a larger scale, for many of these to get involved, require systemic collapse or revolution. I don't think revolution is going to happen.
Sure.
The Scandinavian countries, many people pay 60% of their income. That's they're consecrating two-thirds.
But some of them are probably more comfortable with the secular system than a system where I have no ability to question because it's supposed to be God.
If it's going to be democratic, it's going to have to be partially secular. And in answer to the second part of your question, what could we do? There's some very interesting experiments going on in the United States today. There's an idea called co-housing that was started in Copenhagen and is spread throughout the Scandinavian countries. But there's the first project now being lived in Davis, California. And the idea is that 30 people get together, 30 families, and they build a community, and they have a common nursery, a common dining room, and they dine together 4 to 5 nights a week. And so this is ideal for working parents because they only have to cook dinner on a work night once a month, but they happen to cook it for 70 or 80 people. But this is a project that's working, it's alive, and it's being done by Americans. And I think that Davis, California is a kind of a center for this kind of thinking.
And Ithaca, New York.
And Ithaca, New York.
One short. The first point I guess I would say is that what I'm setting forth is an ideal. We never achieve ideals in mortality, but we have to have an ideal and we have to pursue it, like the gospel is an ideal. And we have to have something against which to measure our intermediate efforts. Secondly, there are lots of experiments, but for people to be forced on a large scale to engage in cooperative activity in the United States is going to take major collapse.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. You probably have another 5 or 10 minutes if you have more questions that you'd like to talk about. And, of course, tapes are available at the information counter. Thank you again.